Yonda Privishama Bavacham Imam Prasuktam Sanjeeva Yadi Akhila Shakti Dharas Sadhamna Anyanscha Hasta Charana Sravanatva Gadi Pamanamma Bhagavade Purushaya Rubhi. Good morning, and today we have a big event that is happening in the city. So I'm told that all the roads are blocked, but many of our friends will be listening to this event online. So let's hope. The subject in front of us today is from religious pluralism to spiritual unity. A very interesting subject. During the last about 10-15 years, religious pluralism is becoming more and more unpopular in many parts of the world. Actually, during the immediate decades of post-war years, that is from 1950s, 60s and 70s, are considered to be the golden era of religious pluralism. Because after the Second World War and many of the terrible things that happened, there was a big movement, a trend towards religious pluralism. The idea that it's not enough to be in the good books of God, but it's also equally important to be a good human being, which is something totally neglected by traditional religious theologies. The main emphasis in traditional religious doctrines was to be in the good books of God, even if that means you are a monster. In behavior, you resemble the devil himself, whom they fear so much. But in doctrine, in faith, we claim to be followers of God. So after the Second World War, actually it began much earlier. It began in the Western world. It began with the advent of Charles Darwin and some of the new discoveries that took place in the mid-19th century. There was a movement towards a movement away from established religious doctrines, a movement towards something that's universal, urge for something universal. So doctrines, rituals, symbols, languages, historical context, and stories, they took a back seat, and people began to ask this question louder and louder. But what does it really mean to be religious? But right now, during the last almost 15 years, with the advent of some of the very, I won't use the word barbaric, but I would be wrong if I use it, tribalistic ideas or interpretation of religion emerged. And as a reaction to this, other religions also began to defend themselves, to be equally committed to their own literal interpretation of scriptures. The literal interpretation is a very important word, a phrase in religious discussions and debates. So anyway, this is a very, very interesting subject. So you find there are many serious theologians discussing, if we practice religious pluralism, and if that means you accept all religions as equally valid and equally spiritual, equally acceptable, then there is always this problem. There are some religious traditions which refuse to move with changing times, which again, as I mentioned, interpret their religion in terms of so many letters, commas, and semicolons, just as they came into existence many centuries ago. Some traditions have already become mature, having gone through different phases in their evolution, they have come to the conclusion that it is not enough to be in the good books of God, but it's also equally important to be a good human being, which cannot be neglected. So that's why, you know, this again, I am reminded, if you read some of the latest views, criticism against religion, you know, you find, you say, there are two doctrines, two ideologies that cause so much of bloodshed and bad name for God and religion, and also humanity. One is the agnostic or atheistic ideologies that began to emerge from 1905 onwards, that first revolution that took place, that claimed to be inspired by Karl Marx, but unfortunately not at all true to his true teachings. So which believed in some kind of monstrous, bloodthirsty ideology, which is purely atheistic, God-denying, some kind of imaginary utopian world state, which never realized, which now it's all about collapsed, unfortunately. Fortunately, collapsed. But the other side, religious fanaticism has not collapsed. It is taking more diabolical terms. So if I stand here and say it is fine to be pluralistic, to be tolerant, all religions are equally valid, but that is true, literally that is true. But the point is, if you're totally blind to the harsh realities that we find manifesting around us, and pretend that everything is fine in this world and God is happy in heaven, that will be an act of hypocrisy. That's why I'm referring to this problem we are facing today. So then we are coming to subject now. So what is the actual definition of pluralism, religious pluralism? First, it recognizes many, many paths, many ways, many methods of making spiritual inquiry. But this is possible only if you accept the basic fact that everyone has an equal right to hold on to his own faith. If a Hindu thinks that his religion is the only true religion, which is actually the sin, it's wrong. But you have to admit that he has a right to believe in what he believes in, but he has no right to impose it upon others, and he has no right to say that God asked me to punish everyone who doesn't share this view. That's the problem arises. Mahatma Gandhi is supposed to be one of the greatest Christians, according to one great Christian evangelist who worked in India, in the central provinces. And I think he was a member of the Church of England. He was not a fanatic. He was just trying to proselytize and try to evangelize people. And he also had an opportunity to try to convert Mahatma Gandhi. And Gandhi, well, he was highly impressed. Gandhi was reading the Bible. And he was a graduate in a temple, had a barrister degree from Inner Temple, was a highly qualified lawyer. And he was considered to be some kind of a bridge between Indian nationalists and British government. At least that's what it now came to be true during the later research programs. So, but he found Gandhi to be a very wonderful man. If you could convert him into Christianity, that means we can get a large number of people in India who would be happy to accept Christianity. But Gandhi, I'm already Christian, he said. The Church of England missionary was shocked. I'm already Christian. But you're not baptized. Why should I be baptized? I believe in all the great teachings of Jesus Christ. And so also I believe in all the great teachings of Buddhism and Hinduism. And then he says something. You know what enabled me to appreciate the great teachings of Christianity and Jesus Christ? He said, it is my Hindu faith that enabled me to see and recognize and appreciate the great truths of other religious traditions, including Christianity. Anyway, he was highly impressed, but he was not very happy. But he said in his writings, in his correspondence to his authorities in London, he wrote, Gandhi is a good man, but a pity, but in good health. But just before independence, 1947, July, 1 month before India got independence, he returned to England, Stanley Jones, and he said, I have met only one Christian in Indian subcontinent, that is Gandhi. So you can imagine the long distance that he traveled. Gandhi actually led him from where he started with in his religious journey, took him to a much higher level of understanding his own faith system. So it's very, very interesting. Now, that's how Gandhi replied, I don't have to convert because I am already a Christian. And according to him, being Christian means that somebody who tries to practice the spiritual teachings of Christ. And he said he could do that because he was a staunch Hindu. It is a very important point, remember. So the point is this, religious pluralism ought to imply, should imply, that your tradition is wonderful for you, my tradition is wonderful for me, and you have every right to believe that your tradition is only genuine truth. That far we can go along the road of pluralism, but you have no right to tell me that he wants to kill anyone who is not willing to share his faith. That's the only point of conflict in religious tradition. And I think Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, of course, naturally, Buddhism, all these traditions have left behind that early stage of religious barbarism, tribalism, but unfortunately there are still some traditions which still remain where they started with 1400 years. That's a different story which I don't want to refer to. So the point that Swami Vivekananda mentioned in modern times is this. It is not just tolerance, it is not even acceptance, which is a higher stage of evolution than tolerance. Rather, it is the idea that you have every right to hold on to your tradition, which is sacred for you, and it's my religious duty to accept that you have a right to follow your own tradition. So also it should be your religious responsibility to accept that I have every right to follow my own tradition. So in the religious life, you can see there is this kind of evolution that takes place. And this evolution takes place at an idea or interpretation, understanding of what God actually implies, what the word God actually means. If I think of God as a monstrous, very muscular, only masculine gender, remember, hefty, well-built, with a huge stick in his hand, absolutely no compromise, he will not take no for an answer. Well, that is, even Vedanta tells you that is okay. But don't ask me to follow that. And don't tell me that I have to accept your view, oh, I have no right to live in this world. Don't say that. So Vedanta is willing to bend backward to any extent to accept and to recognize that you have every right to be a fanatic. But the fanaticism stops where my swinging hand begins. That is the real meaning of spirituality. So in other words, there is an evolution movement. But that is from many to one. From many to one. So what is many? If you read the history of world religions, especially the evolution of the concept of God, there are five stages in the evolution. Pantheism, panentheism, polytheism, henotheism, and monotheism. And Vedanta, of course, takes it to the sixth stage called monism. So pantheism is supposed to be the very beginning of the idea of God. Pantheism implies equating nature with God. God is beauty, when something grand and beautiful and charming and transcendental, awe-inspiring, that is an expression of the divine. The rivers, the mountains, the valleys, the Pacific Ocean, anything that is infinite, that is ever-expanding. In Vedanta, they call it bhuma, meaning something that is unimaginably grand and expanded. But that is not God. That is a manifestation of the power of God. So in that sense, you can see if you read Hendrik Thoreau's Walden, he doesn't go to any church or a temple. He was moving mostly in the wild forests in the East Coast. But he admires the trees and mountains and valleys and rivers and his own pond, the Walden Pond. And he says that he emptied his liquid pot into the Walden Pond and he felt so sorry because he polluted that. That he says, so you find all this in Walden. But he was a pantheist. He was certainly a very spiritual person. So pantheism also can be spiritual. Though a pantheist never goes to a secluded structure called church or temple or synagogue. Because for him the entire creation is an expression of the Almighty. The entire creation is a temple, a shrine. That's also William Wordsworth was a pantheist. Emerson was a pantheist. Because they all admired the great things in nature, the beauty, the charm, and the grandeur, and the power, anything, all inspiring. The next stage in the spiritual evolution, this should be understood properly, then we understand the actual philosophical, spiritual significance of pluralism. Because many people believe that pluralism implies denial of some definite tradition which is given to us. It's not syncretism. It is not kind of indifferentism, they use the word. Indifferentism. They invented the word to attack the followers of exceptionalism. So it is not indifferentism, nor is it exceptionalism. So pantheism implies the kind of universal outlook. Panatheism implies connecting with the inner spirit that is supposed to be present, the indweller in all the great things in nature. Shintoism, an example. In one sense, the ancient early American religious tradition could be called an example of these panatheistic views. Hinduism also, there is this pantheism and panatheism. For example, in many of the ancient Hindu temples, including the one Angkor Wat in Cambodia, is supposed to be several times as big as Vatican. A huge temple structure spread over miles, several miles long and wide, is the biggest religious symbol in architecture, symbol in the world, the Angkor Wat. When it was built in a forest. Even now, it looks like a forest. So, all traditions have something to do with panatheism because the inner spirit, that is the indweller, that is present in all the great, beautiful things of this creation. Polytheism implies the belief that there is one unseen, invisible divine spirit which is controlling all these natural phenomena, rivers and mountains, valleys and so on. You find in Hindu mythology, not in Vedanta, but Hindu mythology. Vedanta accommodates, but it goes far beyond mythology. In Hindu mythology, you find river has a god, Varuna. The sky has a god. The winds have a god, Vayu, and so on. It implies some kind of panatheism. But you believe that there is an inner spirit that is controlling all the natural phenomena. These are different stages, different phases in the evolution of the idea of God. Even far below all days, you can find the ancestor worship, the idea that deceased souls continue to live. Their body is kept alive in the mummies, in the Egyptian pyramids. In Chinese tradition, ancestor worship is a very significant part. They believe in the continued existence of the deceased forefathers. So they pray that the body is gone, but something that is not gone, that is still continuing, that still exists. Polytheism means, again, as I mentioned, different deities controlling all the natural phenomena. Henotheism implies, actually, this idea is directly taken from the Rig Veda Samhita, and these terms that I use just now, pantheism and panatheism, polytheism and henotheism, the fourth one, these are originally explained by Max Müller. He was a German scholar who lived in London, you know, in Oxford, and he was the one who is credited with editing and publishing Rig Veda Samhita, the earliest religious document of Hindu tradition, also earliest existing religious document known to human civilization. So in the introduction, he gives this. He's analyzing different aspects of the ultimate reality mentioned or implied in Rig Veda Samhita. Rig Veda Samhita is a huge religious classic. Begins with Agnimile Purohita, means I am worshipping, I am praying the divine entity is manifesting as fire. Agnimile, I pray to, I propitiate Agni, the fire reality. The ancient Zoroastrians were followers of this tradition. That's why Saint Avesta, which is a textbook of Zoroastrians, and the language of Veda Samhita, there is some affinity, the Vedic language is said to be much more ancient, but still there is some affinity. So henotheism implies, when you are talking about one God, then you say that God is supreme. When you turn to another divinity in nature, that is supreme. Monotheism implies the belief in one presiding supreme Godhead. That's the source of, the genesis of the idea of one supreme God which is acceptable in Abrahamic traditions. The monotheistic idea of Godhead. So pantheism, panatheism, polytheism, henotheism and monotheism. Now, these are the five levels of evolution that Max Müller says could be seen in many ancient religious traditions, which he found explained in the Rig Veda Samhita. But there was another, you know, why I'm explaining this. Basically, I'm a Sanskritist, a Vedic scholar, a bit of a traditional type. But I'm explaining this mostly in relation to the great European Indologists and scholars who expounded these ideas in a language that is intelligible to modern Western audience. That's why I'm referring to them. Max Müller was a scholar, but he could not speak in Sanskrit. He could write it because he had not gone to India and studied. Paul Deussen went to India and studied Sanskrit. Now coming to subject, there was a great and maybe far greater scholar in Europe, that is Schopenhauer. He was another German scholar who happened to read Upanishads, not Rig Veda Samhita, Upanishads. Upanishads constitute the more universal, philosophical, unifying, monistic spiritual ideas. The idea there is one divine spark present everywhere, all-pervading reality. It can manifest in with forms, but it is not limited to any kind of form. So Schopenhauer, when he read the Upanishads, then he found there is something which is still unexplained, left unexplained, undescribed by Max Müller. That was the idea of monism. So monism implies the idea that God can manifest his nature in pantheism, and also as the inner spirit in natural phenomena as panentheism, as the controller, the regulating divine entity behind all natural phenomena as polytheism, and also as monotheism. But he said there are some still higher ideas of God. He says God is present in all of us. Not that we are God, but then the divine spark of God is present in everyone, in everything. That is the Upanishadic philosophy. But that says that it's not enough to worship God. It's also important to manifest our own divinity. Our divinity doesn't mean that we are divine in that sense, but rather the spark of godliness in all of us. That's why I mentioned earlier, the problem is, if you believe that it is enough to be in the good books of God, it is not necessary to be a good human being, that idea is relevant. I mean, that wrong idea is relevant in this context. So, according to Schopenhauer, when he read a very inaccurate translation, that you keep in mind, it's published from the early Upanishads were translated Latin by De Puron, who was a French man, was an infantry soldier study working East India Company, who allowed them to go to different places, and then with the help of some scholars, he translated some of these Upanishads into Latin, from Persian to Latin. It was translated into Persian in the 16th century, 1567, under the Mughal Emperor Dara Shikoh, from Sanskrit to Persian. And in the 19th century, this Frenchman translated this from Persian to Latin, which caught the attention of Schopenhauer, which is not a very accurate translation, and he was overjoyed, because when he read the Upanishads, he thought, he understood, well, it is my own spiritual life that's mentioned here. The universal urge for one's own true spiritual identity. The search for the inner divine spark that is present in all of us. So Schopenhauer says that it is not Hindu's spiritual philosophy alone, it is a spiritual philosophy of entire humanity. Or it should be. But it should be, because far from believing in one God with whom we can have some kind of understanding, agreement, and alliance, so to speak, and he gives us power and ability, oh, you do whatever you want to other fellow human beings who do belong to this tradition. That luxury doesn't exist when you believe that it is important to be a good human being also. It is more important to be a good human being than to be in the good books of the God in whom you believe. Because you cannot be worshipping God in one place and then hating any other living being, even on human being, anywhere else. Because when you see Shankaracharya on this idea, he wrote in 8th century. He was writing a commentary on a much earlier book, which is called Gaudapada Karika. Gaudapada Karika was a predecessor of Shankaracharya, who lived 200 years earlier, in the 6th century AD. So Siddhanta Vyavasthasu Doitino Nishchida Dudham Parasparam Virudhyanti Taihi Ayanna Virudhyanti. This is Sanskrit verse. What it means is, those who believe my tradition is correct, your tradition is wrong, they fight among themselves. But Vedantins don't fight with anyone, because Vedantins accept everyone as non-different from themselves. Because, so he says, Bhashyakara says, Shankaracharya says, Yada Sukhasta Padadibi, that is, Asmadiyoyam Vaidyo Dharmana Viridhyade Atma Ananyatva. The Sanskrit word, as I explained. The same divine spark The same presence of God is present in all of us. Every one of us. Not even in those who don't believe in Him, the divine spark is present. Only he is not able to understand it. When he understands, he becomes a good human being. And the purpose and responsibility and ultimate goal of every religious person is to manifest this inherent inner divinity in actions, in words and thoughts. And that will make him a good human being. Then we realize, well, I can pray to God in my temple, but it's also important that I should be a good human being in my interaction with other fellow human beings. If I hate anyone, then my prayer won't be answered by God. So that is from without to within, from many to one, from gross to subtle, there's an evolution that takes place. When this happens, then we realize the actual implication of the statement that you find in the inscription of the old temple in the Webster Street, Filbert Street, in 1905, when the old temple was built. The great Swami who built that temple, Swami Sukranandidananda, he took one statement from this idea. Ekam sat vikpra bhagudha vadanti. It is just a small part of a much longer verse. Indram mitram varunam akni rahu adho divyasa suparno gurudman ekam sat vikpra bhagudha vadanti aknim yamam matari swanamahu. So what it means is, there are different names that people call the God in whom they believe. It depends upon the place where the prophet is born, the language he spoke, the culture that he belonged to, the parables, the analogy, all the metaphors that a great spiritual teacher uses depends upon the place where he is born. Jesus Christ was born in Palestine. You can't expect him to speak in Sanskrit. Buddha was born in Nepal, at that time India. You can't expect him to speak classical Hebrew. Impossible. The language is different. But if you look at the central teachings, Ekam Sat, the same one reality. Remember, to understand this, you have to look beyond the diversities of culture, language, place, dress code, and so on. So when you look beyond the socio-anthropological cultural diversities, then you find truth is one. The same truth is expounded differently in different traditions, in different languages. In other words, religious harmony becomes a fact when it is grounded on this spiritual realization. In modern times, great teachers like Swami Vivekananda said, spirituality actually goes beyond religions. The idea is from the Vedas. Vivekananda was echoing the teaching of the Vedas. So he said, for example, you may believe in whatever God, whatever tradition you are born into, but true religion becomes a reality when the religion becomes spirituality. And spirituality essentially is what I said earlier, to become a good human being. The good human being, maybe capital letter you can put G, H and B. What it means is a man of compassion, a man of understanding, because you can't quarrel with anyone. You can't fight with anyone. How can you believe in a God who's intelligent, who's supposed to be very smart in modern times, how can you expect him to give one religion, one people, his own people, one religion and tell them, well, this is the only thing I've given to you. All of those fellows are fools, they are following the wrong tradition. You go and force them to accept this. How can you, even a gentleman in modern times won't do that. So we are putting our own prejudices, our own narrow-mindedness on God. We don't want any God greater than ourselves. That's the problem. We cannot believe the idea that God can be greater than us. God should be exactly like us. So a man of strong prejudices will have a very prejudiced God idea. A man who believes in physical strength. I can give you an example. In India, you know, the mythology again, there are some deities. We call, they were all historical figures. Hanuman was a very, you can look at this picture, very muscular man. You don't mess with him. So he's the deity of all wrestlers, traditional wrestling groups. And there are some deities in India. Deity means they were all historical figures who excelled in some sports or something. So, according to wrestler, his god is Hanuman, a very muscular man. Now, musicians, they worship God as the source of all musical skills. Those who believe, those who are farmers, they believe God as the one who gives rains. Nothing wrong in it. Same absolute reality manifests in act of compassion, giving rains. That's one way, nothing wrong in it. But you should not say that is the God you should accept. If you are told to accept Hanuman, the muscular God, you may not feel like accepting him because you are a musician. You would like a God who is more inclined to music, art, things like that. So the problem is, very often, when we think of God, we think the God whom you worship is has got all the prejudices, problems, likes and dislikes of ours. And we superimpose our own problems, our own limitations on the God whom we worship. So Vedanta tells you that the real God is the God of everyone. He is also the God of those who don't believe in him. This is something very interesting. I often quote this statement. I am not tired of repeating this quotation by Vivekananda. Very, very profound quotation. But he says, you live your life in such a way, you live your life in such a way that God accepts you even if you don't accept him. Think of that. If you become a good human being, God cannot shut his doors in front of you. Suppose Christ and Buddha together go to, let's say, to the place of God, and that God doesn't belong to Christianity or Buddhism. And if that God tells you, no, you have no entry here because you are at a, you don't belong to my tradition, then what kind of God is he? That better not to go there where he's living. So the point is, God should be the God of everyone, even of those who don't belong to his tradition. That's why Vivekananda said, the actual meaning of religion is spirituality. And spirituality is not rituals, doctrines, or theologies. These are helpful, these are necessary, need not, they should be accommodated. But our idea of God or religion should not end there. When we come out of the temple, we should not think that we are not seeing God, we are seeing devils. No. The same God whom we see inside the temple, we should see outside also. Then what happens is, we become truly spiritual. So, spirituality is based on experience and practice and actual implementation of what we believe in, not in faith alone. Faith is important, but that faith should express itself in the form of compassion, harmony, a helping spirit, and also a broad-minded outlook when we deal with other fellow human beings. Otherwise, it is not spirituality. It is not any kind of superficial relativism. It is also another problem. Or loss of depth. Or reducing religion to some kind of vague statement or ignoring the deeper implications. No. See, it should not become relativism. Sometimes, when it becomes relativism, it becomes superficial. So that's why Vivekananda said, you know, why I'm quoting Vivekananda? Because if you look at the history of world religions, though many of these ideas were already expressed in ancient Sanskrit texts, Hindu tradition, Buddhism also, but this idea of Vedanta was not very well known to Western world before Vivekananda came to this country in 1893. It was certainly known to some great transcendentalists like Emerson, Thoreau, Whitman and others. But there was no authentic teacher who came and preached this. So when Vivekananda came to America in 1893, he found it was a fertile land because the land was made ready by Emerson, Thoreau and Whitman. So if you read the writings of these three great transcendentalists and also some of the great writers, intellectuals who lived in America during the later half of 19th century, especially after the Civil War, you find there was a great opening of the universal spirit. People were looking for something universal. They fed up with this narrow doctrines and idea, saying that this is wrong, you should bring him here, that tradition is wrong, our tradition is correct. People were not very happy with that sort of thing. People wanted to believe in something universal, something humanistic and something humanizing. True religion should make us good human beings. And you cannot become a good human being if you hate anyone in this world. Just because he believes in another tradition is impossible. Because the same God created everyone. The same God created those who refuse to accept him even. So how can we ever say that God is merciful, God is omnipotent, God is omnipresent, at the same time that God has a special consideration for me and he doesn't like others. We are superimposing our own prejudices, our own limitations on God himself. That's why when a Gandhi, man like Gandhi, had a copy of Bible in his hand, when a man like Vivekananda used to have a copy of the Imitation of Christ in his pocket. Not that he was a Christian, he was not going to church. But he could see the greatness of Dr. Bethel writing the Imitation of Christ. He could understand. Anyone who meditates, anyone who worships a pure heart, anyone who has compassion in his heart, anyone who believes in unselfishness, he cannot fail to see those qualities in other fellow human beings. It's so contagious. If you're praying in your own heart, in your own temple, in your own church, with all sincerity, then you cannot come out of the church and temple and hate anyone else. Otherwise, you know, we are limiting spirituality to 2 hours in the morning, 1 hour in the morning, 1 hour in the evening, maybe only one day of the week. So that's why Gandhi could appreciate Christianity, though he was not baptized. Vivekananda could appreciate Christianity because he was not baptized. There were many great Christians also. You went to Schopenhauer, Max Müller, were born into non-Hindu traditions. When they read the Upanishads, they were surprised, they could see, their eyes were opened. There were great truths. Maybe they were praying every day. Maybe not externally, but in their heart they were praying. When you actually pray, when you sincerely practice any religious tradition with a pure heart, then you cannot fail to see the greatness of any other tradition. Because that prayer opens our hearts, makes our heart ready to see and relate greatness and appreciate greatness in other traditions. Because that's how mind works. When you do good things, then be compassionate, broad-minded, introspective, meditative, and think of God, then you cannot really fail to see the same spark in other traditions or the followers of other faith systems. That's the real purpose of pluralism. Pluralism means you believe, well, things are different. There are many traditions, but all these traditions are basically genuine so far the experience is concerned. Going beyond rituals, beyond practices, beyond external practices, when it comes to actual inner experience, the way we react to the idea of God, that is the same. a praying Christian, a praying Hindu, a praying Buddhist, a praying Jewish person, they will have the same attitude. All of them pray. If all of them just read and shout and try to convert others, try to transform others into transforming themselves, then there will be no end to problem. So pluralism can be a blessing. It will be celebrated because pluralism also implies the reality of unity of one. That pluralistic traditions are different manifestations. Pluralistic manifestations of the same one divine truth. That's the idea behind. So I tried to give a bird view of some of these ideas. But actually, our times need these great ideas, liberating ideas, spiritually liberating ideas more than any time. So thank you so much. Thank you. Om Shanti, 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 Hari Om, that's it. Sri Ramakrishna Pranamastu.